went down. Like every small boy in America, he had hated the Japs and played games in which he slaughtered them by the dozen in his imagination. And his daddy was an invincible hero, tall and handsome, brave and strong and all-conquering. He could still feel the overpowering rage that had gripped him when he found out the Japs had killed Daddy. He had prayed to God to make the war go on long enough for him to grow up and join the Navy himself and kill a million Japs in revenge. He had never killed anyone, but he had never hired a Japanese employee or admitted a Japanese student to a school or offered a Japanese psychologist a job. A lot of men, faced with a problem, asked themselves what their father would have done about it. Friends had told him this. It was a privilege he would never have. He had been too young to get to know his father. He had no idea what Lieutenant Jones would have done in a crisis. He had never really had a father, just a superhero. He would question Jeannie Ferrami about her recruitment methods. Then, he decided, he would ask her to have dinner with him. He called Jeannie's internal number. She picked up right away. He lowered his voice and spoke in a tone that his ex-wife Vivi used to call furry. "Jeannie, it's Barry," he said. She was characteristically direct. "What the heck is going on?" she said. "Could I talk to you for a minute, please?" "Sure. Would you mind stepping into my office?" "I'll be right there." She hung up. As he waited for her, he wondered idly how many women he had bedded. It would take too long to recall them one by one, but maybe he could approximate scientifically. It was more than one, more than 10, certainly. Was it more than 100? That would be 2.5 per year since he was 19. He had certainly had more than that. 1,000? 25 per year. A new woman every 2 weeks for 40 years? No, he had not done that well. During the 10 years he had been married to Vivi Ellington, he had probably had no more than 15 or 20 adulterous liaisons in total. But he had made up for it afterward. Somewhere between 100 and 1,000, then. But he was not going to take Jeannie to bed. He was going to find out how the hell she had come into contact with Steve Logan. Jeannie knocked at the door and came in. She was wearing a white laboratory coat over her skirt and blouse. Barrington liked it when the young women wore those coats as dresses, with nothing else but their underwear. He found it sexy. "Good of you to come by," he said. He drew out a chair for her, then pulled his own chair around from behind his desk so there would not be a barrier between them. His first task was to give Jeannie some plausible explanation for his behavior on meeting Stephen Logan. She would not be easy to fool. He wished he had given it more thought, instead of counting up his conquests. He sat down and gave her his most disarming grin. "I want to apologize for my weird behavior," he said. "I've been downloading some files from the University of Sydney, Australia." He gestured at his desktop computer. "Just as you were about to introduce me to that young man, I realized I had left my computer on and forgotten to hang up the phone line. I just felt kind of foolish, that's all. But I was pretty rude." The explanation was thin, but she seemed to accept it. "I'm relieved," she said candidly. "I thought I had done something to offend you." "So far, so good. I was on my way to talk to you about your work," he went on smoothly. "You've certainly got off to a flying start. You've only been here 4 weeks, and your project is well underway. Congratulations." She nodded. "I had long talks with Herb and Frank over the summer, before I officially started," she said. Herb Dixon was the department head, and Frank Demidenko a full professor. "We figured out all the practicalities in advance." "Tell me a little more about it. Have any problems come up?
Anything I can help with?"
"Recruitment is my biggest problem," she said. "Because our subjects are volunteers, most of them are like Steve Logan, respectable middle-class Americans who believe that the good citizen has a duty to support scientific inquiry. Not many pimps and dope dealers come forward, a point our liberal critics haven't failed to make. On the other hand, it's not possible to find out about aggression and criminality by studying law-abiding middle American families, So it was absolutely crucial to my project that I solved the recruitment problem.
And have you?
I think so. It occurred to me that medical information about millions of people is nowadays held on huge databases by insurance companies and government agencies. That includes the kind of data we use to determine whether twins are identical or paternal. Brainwaves, electrocardiograms, and so on. If we could search for pairs of similar electrocardiograms, for example, it would be a way of identifying twins. And if the database was big enough, some of those pairs would have been raised apart. And here's the kicker. Some of them might not even know they were twins.
It's remarkable, Barrington said.
Simple, but original and ingenious. He meant it. Identical twins reared apart were very important to genetics research, and scientists went to great lengths to recruit them. Until now, the main way to find them had been through publicity. They read magazine articles about twin studies and volunteered to take part. As Jeannie said, that process gave a sample that was predominantly respectable, middle class, which was a disadvantage in general and a crippling problem to the study of criminality. But for him personally, it was a catastrophe. He looked her in the eye and tried to hide his dismay. This was worse than he had feared. Only last night, Preston Bark had said, "We all know this company has secrets." Jim Proust had said no one could find them out. He had not reckoned with Jeannie Ferrami. Barrington clutched at a straw. Finding similar entries in a database is not as easy as it sounds. True, graphic images use up many megabytes of space. Searching such records is vastly more difficult than running a spell check on your doctoral thesis. I believe it's quite a problem in software design. So what did you do?
I wrote my own software.
Barrington was surprised.
You did?
Sure. I took a master's in computer science at Princeton, as you know. When I was at Minnesota, I worked with my professor on neural network-type software for pattern recognition.
Could she be that smart?
How does it work? It uses fuzzy logic to speed up pattern matching. The pairs we're looking for are similar, but not absolutely identical. For example, X-rays of identical teeth taken by different technicians on different machinery are not exactly the same, but the human eye can see that they're the same. And when the X-rays are scanned and digitized and stored electronically, a computer equipped with fuzzy logic can recognize them as a pair.
I imagine you'd need a computer the size of the Empire State Building.
I figured out a way to shorten the process of pattern matching by looking at a small portion of the digitized image. Think about it. To recognize a friend, you don't need to scan his whole body, just his face. Automobile enthusiasts can identify most common cars from a photograph of one headlight. My sister can name any Madonna track after listening to about 10 seconds of it.
That's open to error.
She shrugged. By not scanning the entire image, you risk overlooking some matches. I figured out that you can radically shorten the search process with only a small margin of error. It's a question of statistics and probabilities. All psychologists studied statistics, of course. But how can the same program scan X-rays and electrocardiograms and fingerprints? It recognizes electronic patterns. It doesn't care what they represent.
And your program works?
It seems to. I got permission to try it out on a database of dental records held by a large medical insurance company. It produced several hundred pairs, but of course I'm only interested in twins who have been raised apart.
How do you pick them out?
I eliminated all the pairs with the same surname, and all the married women, since most of them have taken the husband's name. The remainder are twins with no apparent reason for having different surnames.
Ingenious, Barrington thought.
He was torn between admiration of Jeannie and fear of what she could find out.
How many were left?
3 pairs. Kind of a disappointment. I was hoping for more. In one case, one of the twins had changed his surname for religious reasons. He had become a Muslim and taken an Arab name. Another pair had disappeared without a trace. Fortunately, the 3rd pair are just what I was looking for. Stephen Logan is a law-abiding citizen, and Dennis Pinker is a murderer. Barrington knew that. Late one evening, Dennis Pinker had cut the electric power to a movie theater in the middle of a Friday the 13th movie. In the ensuing panic, he had molested several women. One girl had apparently tried to fight him off, and he had killed her. So Jeannie had found Dennis. Christ, he thought, she's dangerous. She could ruin everything. The takeover, Jim's political career, Genetico, even Barrington's academic reputation. Fear made him angry. How could everything he had ever worked for be threatened by his own protégé? But there was no way he could have known what would happen. Her being here at Jones Falls was lucky, in that he had early warning of what she was up to. However, he saw no way out. If only her files could be destroyed in a fire, or she could be killed in a car wreck. But that was fantasy. Might it be possible to undermine her faith in her software? Did Stephen Logan know he was adopted? He said with hidden malice. No. Jeannie's brow wrinkled in a troubled frown. We know that families often lie about adoption, but he thinks his mother would have told him the truth. But there may be another explanation. Suppose they were unable to adopt through the normal channels, for some reason, and they bought a baby. They might lie about that. Or your system could be flawed, Barrington suggested. Just because two boys have identical teeth doesn't guarantee they're twins. I don't think my system is flawed, Jeannie said briskly, but I am worried about telling dozens of people that they might be adopted. I'm not even sure I have the right to invade their lives in that way. I've only just realized the magnitude of the problem. He looked at his watch. I'm running out of time, but I'd love to discuss this some more. Are you free for dinner? Tonight? Yes. He saw her hesitate. They had had dinner together once before, at the International Congress of Twin Studies, where they had first met. Since she had been at JFU, they had had drinks together once in the bar of the faculty club on campus. One Saturday, they had met by accident in a shopping street in Charles Village, and Barrington had shown her around the Baltimore Museum of Art. She was not in love with him, not by a long shot, but he knew she had enjoyed his company on those three occasions. Besides, he was her mentor. It was hard for her to refuse him. Sure, she said. Shall we go to Hampton's, at the Harbor Court Hotel? I think it's the best restaurant in Baltimore. It was the swankiest, anyway. Fine, she said, standing up. Then I'll pick you up at 8. Okay. As she turned away from him, Barrington was visited by a sudden vision of her naked back, smooth and muscular, and her flat ass, and her long, long legs. And for a moment his throat went dry with desire. Then she shut the door. Barrington shook his head to clear his mind of lascivious fantasy, then called Preston again. It's worse than we thought, he said without preamble. She's written a computer program that searches medical databases and finds matched pairs. First time she tried it out, she found Stephen and Dennis. Shit. We've got to tell Jim. The three of us should get together and decide what the hell we're going to do. How about tonight? I'm taking Jeannie to dinner. Do you think that may solve the problem? It can't hurt. I still think we'll have to pull out of the Landsman deal in the end. I don't agree, Barrington said. She's pretty bright, but one girl isn't going to uncover the whole story in a week. However, as he hung up, he wondered if he should be so sure. 8. The students in the human biology lecture theater were restive. Their concentration was poor and they fidgeted. Jeannie knew why. She too felt unnerved. It was the fire and the rape. Their cozy academic world had been destabilized. Everyone's attention kept wandering as their minds went back again and again to what had happened. Observed variations in the intelligence of human beings can be explained by 3 factors, Jeannie said. 1, different genes. 2, a different environment. 3, measurement error. She paused. They all wrote in their notebooks. She had noticed this effect. Anytime she offered a numbered list, they would all write it down. If she had simply said, different genes, different environments, and experimental error, most of them would have written nothing. Since she had first observed this syndrome, she included as many numbered lists as possible in her lectures. She was a good teacher, somewhat to her surprise. In general, she felt her people skills were poor. She was impatient, and she could be abrasive, as she had been this morning with Sergeant Delaware. But she was a good communicator, clear and precise, and she enjoyed explaining things. There was nothing better than the kick of seeing enlightenment dawn in a student's face. "We can express this as an equation," she said, and she turned around and wrote on the board with a stick of chalk. VT equals VG plus VE plus VM. VT being the total variance, VG the genetic component, VE the environmental, and VM the measurement error. They all wrote down the equation. The same may be applied to any measurable difference between human beings, from their height and weight to their tendency to believe in God. Can anyone here find fault with this? No one spoke, so she gave them a clue. The sum may be greater than the parts. But why? One of the young men spoke up. It was usually the men. The women were irritatingly shy. Because genes and the environment act upon one another to multiply effects? Exactly. Your genes steer you toward certain environmental experiences and away from others. Babies with different temperaments elicit different treatments from their parents. Active toddlers have different experiences than sedentary ones, even in the same house. Daredevil adolescents take more drugs than choir boys in the same town. We must add to the right-hand side of the equation the term CGE, meaning gene-environment covariation. She wrote it on the board, then looked at the Swiss Army watch on her wrist. It was 5 to 4. Any question? For a change, it was a woman who spoke up. She was Donna Marie Dixon, a nurse who had gone back to school in her 30s. Bright, but shy. She said, "What about the Osmonds?" The class laughed and the woman blushed. Jeannie said gently, "Explain what you mean, Donna Marie. Some of the class may be too young to remember the Osmonds." "They were a pop group in the 70s, all brothers and sisters. The Osmond family are all musical, but they don't have the same genes. They're not twins. It seems to have been the family environment that made them all musicians. Same with the Jackson Five." The others, who were mostly younger, laughed again, and the woman smiled bashfully and added, "I'm giving away my age here." "Miss Dixon makes an important point, and I'm surprised no one else thought of it," Jeannie said. She was not surprised at all, but Donna Marie needed to have her confidence boosted. Charismatic and dedicated parents may make all their children conform to a certain ideal, regardless of their genes, just as abusive parents may turn out a whole family of schizophrenics. But these are extreme cases. A malnourished child will be short in stature, even if its parents and grandparents are all tall. An overfed child will be fat, even if it has thin ancestors. Nevertheless, every new study tends to show, more conclusively than the last, that it is predominantly the genetic inheritance, rather than the environment or style of upbringing, that determines the nature of the child. She paused. "If there are no more questions, please read Bouchard et al. In Science, 12 October 1990, before next Monday." Jeannie picked up her papers. They began packing up their books. She hung around for a few moments to create an opportunity for students too timid to ask questions in open class to approach her privately. Introverts often became great scientists. It was Donna Marie who came up to the front. She had a round face and fair curly hair. Jeannie thought she must have been a good nurse, calm and efficient. "I'm so sorry about poor Lisa," Donna Marie said. "What a terrible thing to happen." "And the police made it worse," Jeannie said. "The cop who drove her to the hospital was a real asshole, frankly." "That's too bad. But maybe they'll catch the guy who did it. They're passing out flyers with his picture all over the campus." "Good." The picture Donna Marie was talking about must have been produced by Mish Delaware's computer program. When I left her this morning, she was working on the picture with a detective. "How's she feeling?" "Still numb. But jumpy, too." Donna Marie nodded. "They go through phases. I've seen it before. The first phase is denial. They say, 'I just want to put it all behind me and get on with my life.' But it's never that easy.
She should talk to you. Knowing what to expect might help her.
Any time, Donna Marie said.
Jeannie walked across the campus toward Nutt House.
It was still hot. She found herself looking around watchfully, like a nervous cowboy in a Western movie, expecting someone to come around the corner of the freshman's residence and attack her. Until now, the campus of Jones Falls had seemed like an oasis of old-fashioned tranquility in the desert of a modern American city. Indeed, JFU was like a small town, with its shops and banks, sports fields and parking meters, bars and restaurants, offices and homes. It had a population of 5,000, of whom half lived on campus. But it had been turned into a dangerous landscape. That guy had no right to do this, Jeannie thought bitterly, to make me feel afraid in my own place of work. Maybe a crime always had this effect, causing the solid ground to seem unsteady beneath your feet. As she entered her office, she started thinking about Barrington Jones. He was an attractive man, very attentive to women. Whenever she had spent time with him, she had enjoyed herself. She was also indebted to him, for he had given her this job. On the other hand, he was a bit oily. She suspected that his attitude to women might be manipulative. He always made her think of the joke about a man who says to a woman, "Tell me all about yourself. What's your opinion of, for example, me?" In some ways, he did not seem like an academic, but Jeannie had observed that the real go-getters of the university world noticeably lacked the vague, helpless air of the stereotype absent-minded professor. Barrington looked and acted like a powerful man. He had not done great scientific work for some years, but that was normal. Brilliant original discoveries, such as the double helix, were usually made by people under 35. As scientists got older, they used their experience and instincts to help and direct younger, fresher minds. Barrington did that well, with his 3 professorships and his role as conduit for Genetico's research money. He was not as respected as he might have been, however, because other scientists disliked his involvement in politics. Jeannie herself thought his science was good and his politics were crap. At first, she had readily believed Barrington's story about downloading files from Australia. But on reflection, she was not so sure. When Barry had looked at Stephen Logan, he had seen a ghost, not a phone bill. Many families had parenthood secrets. A married woman might have a lover, and only she would know who was the real father of her child. A young girl might have a baby and give it to her mother, pretending to be an older sister, the whole family conspiring to keep the secret. Children were adopted by neighbors, relatives, and friends who concealed the truth. Lorraine Logan might not be the type to make a dark secret of a straightforward adoption, but she could have a dozen other reasons for lying to Stephen about his origins. But how was Barrington involved? Could he be Stephen's real father? The thought made Jeannie smile. Barry was handsome, but he was at least 6 inches shorter than Stephen. Although anything was possible, that particular explanation seemed unlikely. It bothered her to have a mystery. In every other respect, Stephen Logan represented a triumph for her. He was a decent, law-abiding citizen with an identical twin brother who was a violent criminal. Steve vindicated her computer search program and confirmed her theory of criminality. Of course, she would need another 100 pairs of twins like Stephen and Dennis before she could talk about proof. All the same, she could not have had a better start to her program of research. Tomorrow, she would see Dennis. If he turned out to be a dark-haired dwarf, she would know something had gone badly wrong. But if she were right, he would be Stephen Logan's double. She had been shaken by the revelation that Steve Logan had no idea he might be adopted. She was going to have to work out some procedure for dealing with this phenomenon. In the future, she could contact the parents and check how much they had told before approaching the twins. It would slow her work, but it had to be done. She could not be the one to reveal family secrets. That problem was soluble, but she could not lose the sense of anxiety caused by Barrington's skeptical questions and Stephen Logan's incredulity, and she began to think anxiously of the next stage of her project. She was hoping to use her software to scan the FBI's fingerprint file. It was the perfect source for her. Many of the 22 million people on file had been suspected or convicted of crimes. If her program worked, it should yield hundreds of twins, including several raised-apart pairs. It could mean a quantum leap forward in her research. But first, she had to get the Bureau's permission. Her best friend at school had been Geeta Sumra, a math wizard of Asian Indian descent who now had a top job managing information technology for the FBI. She worked in Washington, D.C., but lived here in Baltimore. Geeta had already agreed to ask her employers to cooperate with Jeannie. She had promised a decision by the end of this week, but now Jeannie wanted to hurry her. She dialed her number. Geeta had been born in Washington, but her voice still held a hint of the Indian subcontinent in its softness of tone and roundness of vowels. "Hey, Jeannie, how was your weekend?" she said. "Awful," Jeannie told her. "My mom finally flipped, and I had to put her in a home." "I'm sorry to hear that. What did she do?" "She forgot it was the middle of the night, got up, forgot to get dressed, went out to buy a carton of milk, and forgot where she lived." "What happened?" "The police found her. Fortunately, she had a check from me in her purse, and they were able to track me down." "How do you feel about it?" That was a female question. The men, Jack Budgen, Barrington Jones, had asked what she was going to do. It took a woman to ask how she felt. "Bad," she said. "If I have to take care of my mother, who's going to take care of me, you know? What kind of place is she in?" "Cheap. It's all her insurance will cover. I have to get her out of there as soon as I can find the money to pay for something better." She heard a pregnant silence at the other end of the line and realized that Geeta thought she was being asked for money. "I'm going to do some private tutoring on the weekends," she added hastily. "Did you talk to your boss about my proposal yet?" "As a matter of fact, I did." Jeannie held her breath. "Everyone here is real interested in your software," Geeta said. That was neither a yes nor a no. "You don't have computer scanning systems?" "We do, but your search engine is faster by far than anything we've got. They're talking about licensing the program from you." "Wow! Maybe I won't need to do private tuition on the weekends after all." End of side two. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over. Side three. The Third Twin by Ken Follett. Continuing on page 79. Geeta laughed. "Before you open the champagne, let's make sure the program actually works." "How soon can we do that?" "We'll run it at night for minimal interference with normal use of the database. I'll have to wait for a quiet night. It should happen within a week. Two at most." "No faster?" "Is there a rush?" There was, but Jeannie was reluctant to tell Geeta of her worries. "I'm just impatient," she said. "I'll get it done as soon as possible. Don't worry. Can you upload the program to me by modem?" "Sure, but don't you think I need to be there when you run it?" "No, I don't, Jeannie," Geeta said with a smile in her voice. "Of course, you know more about this kind of stuff than I do." "Here's where to send it." Geeta read out an email address and Jeannie wrote it down. "I'll send you the results the same way." "Thanks. Hey, Geeta."
"What?"
"Am I going to need a tax shelter?"
"Get out of here."
Geeta laughed and hung up. Jeannie clicked her mouse on America Online and accessed the Internet. As her search program was uploading to the FBI, there was a knock at her door, and Stephen Logan came in. She looked at him appraisingly. He had been given disturbing news, and it showed in his face, but he was young and resilient, and the shock had not brought him down. He was psychologically very stable. If he had been a criminal type, as his brother Dennis presumably was, he would have picked a fight with someone by now. "How are you doing?" she asked him. He closed the door behind him with his heel. "All finished," he said. "I've undergone all the tests and completed each examination and filled out every questionnaire that can be devised by the ingenuity of humankind." "Then you're free to go home." "I was thinking of staying in Baltimore for the evening. As a matter of fact, I wondered if you'd care to have dinner with me." She was taken by surprise. "What for?" she said ungraciously. The question threw him. "Well,
For one thing, I'd sure like to know more about your research.
Oh. Well, unfortunately, I have a dinner engagement already.
He looked very disappointed. Do you think I'm too young?
For what?
To take you out.
Then it struck her.
I didn't know you were asking me for a date, she said.
He was embarrassed.
You're kind of slow to catch on.
I'm sorry.
She was being slow. He had come on to her yesterday on the tennis court, but she had spent all day thinking of him as a subject for study. However, now that she thought about it, he was too young to take her out. He was 22, a student. She was 7 years older. It was a big gap.
He said,
"How old is your date?"
59 or 60, something like that.
Wow, you like old men.
Jeannie felt bad about turning him down. She owed him something, she thought, after what she had put him through. Her computer made a doorbell sound to tell her that the program had finished uploading. I'm through here for the day, she said. Would you like to have a drink in the faculty club?
He brightened immediately. Sure, I'd love to. Am I dressed okay?
He was wearing khakis and a blue linen shirt.
You'll be better dressed than most of the professors there, she said, smiling.
She exited and turned her computer off.
I called my mom, Stephen said, told her about your theory.
Was she mad?
She laughed, said I wasn't adopted, nor did I have a twin brother who was put up for adoption.
Strange. It was a relief to Jeannie that the Logan family was taking all this so calmly. On the other hand, their laid-back skepticism made her worry that perhaps Stephen and Dennis were not twins after all.
You know,
she hesitated. She had said enough shocking things to him today, but she plunged on.
There is another possible way you and Dennis could be twins. I know what you're thinking, he said. Baby switched to the hospital.
He was very quick. This morning she had noticed more than once how fast he worked things out.
That's right, she said. Mother number one has identical twin boys. Mothers two and three each have a boy. The twins are given to mothers two and three, and their babies are given to mother number one. As the children grow up, mother number one concludes that she has fraternal twins who bear one another remarkably little resemblance. And if mothers two and three don't happen to be acquainted, no one ever observes the startling resemblance between babies two and three. It's the old staple of the romance writers, she admitted, but it's not impossible.
Is there a book on this twin stuff, he said. I'd like to know more about it.
Yeah, I have one.
She looked along her bookshelf.
No, it's at home.
Where do you live?
Close by.
You could take me home for that drink.
She hesitated.
This one is the normal twin, she reminded herself. Not the psychopath.
He said, you know so much about me after today. I'm curious about you. I'd like to see where you live.
Jeannie shrugged.
Sure, why not? Let's go.
It was 5 o'clock, and the day was at last beginning to cool as they left Nut House. Steve whistled when he saw the red Mercedes.
What a neat car.
I've had it for 8 years, she said. I love it. My car's in the parking lot. I'll come up behind you and flash my lights. He left. Jeannie got into her car and started it. A few minutes later, she saw headlights in her rearview mirror. She pulled out of her parking space and drove off. As she left the campus, she noticed a police cruiser tucking behind Steve's car. She checked her speedometer and slowed down to 30. It seemed Stephen Logan was smitten with her. Although she did not reciprocate his feelings, she was kind of pleased. It was flattering to have won the heart of a handsome young hunk. He stayed on her tail all the way home. She pulled up outside her house, and he parked right behind her. As in many old Baltimore streets, there was a row stoop, a communal front porch that ran the length of the row, where neighbors had sat cooling themselves in the days before air conditioning. She crossed the stoop and stood at her door, getting out her keys. Two cops exploded out of the patrol car, guns in their hands. They took up firing positions, their arms stretched out stiffly, their guns pointed directly at Jeannie and Steve. Jeannie's heart stopped. Stephen said, "What the fuck?" Then one of the men yelled, "Police! Freeze!"
Jeannie and Steve both raised their hands. But the police did not relax.
On the floor, motherfucker, one of them screamed. Face down, hands behind your back.
Jeannie and Steve both lay face down. The policeman approached them as cautiously as if they were ticking bombs. Jeannie said, don't you think you'd better tell us what this is about?
You can stand up, lady, said one.
Gee, thanks. She got to her feet. Her heart was beating fast, but it seemed obvious the cops had made some kind of dumb mistake.
Now that you've scared me half to death, what the hell is going on?
Still, they did not reply. They all kept their guns pointed at Steve. One of them knelt beside him, and with a swift, practiced motion, handcuffed him.
You're under arrest, cocksucker, the cop said.
Jeannie said, I'm a broad-minded woman, but is all this cursing really necessary? Nobody took any notice of her. She tried again. What's he supposed to have done, anyway? A light blue Dodge Colt screeched to a halt behind the police cruiser, and two people got out. One was Mish Delaware, the detective from the Sex Crimes Unit. She had on the same skirt and blouse she had worn this morning, but she wore a linen jacket that only partly concealed the gun at her hip.
You got here fast, said one of the patrolmen.
I was in the neighborhood, she replied. She looked at Steve, lying on the floor.
Get him up, she said.
The patrolman took Steve by the arm and helped him stand.
It's him, all right, Mish said. This is the guy who raped Lisa Hoxton.
Stephen did?
Jeannie said incredulously.
Jesus, I was about to take him into my apartment.
Rape?
Stephen said. The patrolman spotted his car leaving the campus, Mish said. Jeannie noticed Steve's car for the first time. It was a tan Datsun, about 15 years old. Lisa had thought she saw the rapist driving an old white Datsun. Her initial shock and alarm began to give way to rational thought. The police suspected him. That did not make him guilty. What was the evidence? She said, if you're going to arrest every man you see driving a rusty Datsun... Mish handed Jeannie a piece of paper. It was a flyer bearing a computer-generated black-and-white picture of a man. Jeannie stared at it. It did look something like Stephen.
It might be him, and it might not, Jeannie said.
What are you doing with him?
He's a subject. We've been doing tests on him at the lab.
I can't believe he's the guy.
Her test findings showed that Stephen had the inherited personality of a potential criminal, but they also showed that he had not developed into an actual criminal. Mish said to Stephen, can you account for your movements yesterday between 7 and 8 p.m.?
Well, I was at JFU, Stephen said.
What were you doing?
Nothing much. I was supposed to go out with my cousin Ricky, but he canceled. I came here to check out where I had to be this morning. I had nothing else to do.
It sounded lame, even to Jeannie. Maybe Steve was the rapist, she thought with dismay. But if he was, her entire theory was shot.
Mish said, how did you spend your time?
I watched the tennis for a while. Then I went to a bar in Charles Village and spent a couple of hours. I missed the big fire.
Can anyone corroborate what you say?
Well, I spoke to Dr. Farami, although at that point I didn't actually know who she was. Mish turned to Jeannie. Jeannie saw hostility in her eyes and recalled how they had clashed this morning when Mish was persuading Lisa to cooperate. Jeannie said, it was after my tennis game, a few minutes before the fire broke out.
Mish said, so you can't tell us where he was when the rape took place?
No, but I'll tell you something else. I've spent all day giving this man tests, and he doesn't have the psychological profile of a rapist.
Mish looked scornful. That's not evidence.
Jeannie was still holding the flyer.
Nor is this, I guess.
She balled it up and dropped it on the sidewalk. Mish jerked her head at the cops.
Let's go.
Stephen spoke in a clear, calm voice.
Wait a minute.
They hesitated.
Jeannie, I don't care about these guys, but I want to tell you that I didn't do this, and I never would do anything of the kind.
She believed him. She asked herself why. Was it just that she needed him to be innocent for her theory? No,
She had the psychological tests to show that he had none of the characteristics associated with criminals. But there was something else. Her intuition. She felt safe with him. He gave out no wrong signals. He listened when she talked. He did not try to bully her. He did not touch her inappropriately. He showed no anger or hostility. He liked women, and he respected her. He was not a rapist. She said, "Do you want me to call someone? Your parents?" "No," he said decisively. "They'd worry, and it will all be over in a few hours. I'll tell them then." "Aren't they expecting you home tonight?" "I said I might stay with Ricky again." "Well, if you're sure," she said dubiously. "I'm sure." "Let's go," Mish said impatiently. "What's the damn hurry?" Jeannie snapped. "You have some other innocent people to arrest?" Mish glared at her. "Do you have anything more to say to me?" "What happens next?" "There'll be a lineup. We'll let Lisa Hoxton decide whether this is the man that raped her." With facetious deference, Mish added, "Is that okay with you, Dr. Ferrami?" "That's just fine," Jeannie said. 9. They took Steve downtown in the pale blue Dodge Colt. The woman detective drove, and the other one, a heavy-set white man with a mustache, sat beside her, looking cramped in the little car. No one spoke. Steve quietly seethed with resentment. Why the hell should he be riding in this uncomfortable car, his wrists in handcuffs, when he ought to be sitting in Jeannie Ferrami's apartment with a cold drink in his hand? They had just better get this over with quickly. That was all. Police headquarters was a pink granite building in Baltimore's red light district, among the topless bars and porn outlets. They drove up a ramp and parked in the internal garage. It was full of police cruisers and cheap compacts like the Colt. They took Steve up in an elevator and put him in a room with yellow-painted walls and no windows. They took off his handcuffs, then left him alone. He assumed they locked the door. He did not check. There was a table and two hard plastic chairs. On the table was an ashtray containing two cigarette butts, both filter tips, one with lipstick on. Set into the door was a pane of opaque glass. Steve could not see out, but he guessed they could see in. Looking at the ashtray, he wished he smoked. It would be something to do here in this yellow cell. Instead, he paced up and down. He told himself he could not really be in trouble. He had managed to get a look at the picture on the flyer, and although it was more or less like him, it was not him. No doubt he resembled the rapist, but when he stood in the lineup with several other tall young men, the victim would not pick him out. After all, the poor woman must have looked long and hard at the bastard who did it. His face would be burned into her memory. She would not make a mistake. But the cops had no right to keep him waiting like this. Okay, they had to eliminate him as a suspect, but they did not have to take all night about it. He was a law-abiding citizen. He tried to look on the bright side. He was getting a close-up view of the American justice system. He would be his own lawyer. It would be good practice. When in the future he represented a client accused of a crime, he would know what the person was going through in police custody. He had seen the inside of a precinct house once before, but that had felt very different. He was only 15. He had gone to the police with one of his teachers. He had admitted the crime immediately and told the police candidly everything that had happened. They could see his injuries. It was obvious the fight had not been one-sided. His parents had come to take him home. That had been the most shameful moment of his life, when Mom and Dad walked into that room. Steve wished he were dead. Dad looked mortified, as if he had suffered a great humiliation. Mom's expression showed grief. They both looked bewildered and wounded. At the time, it was all he could do not to burst into tears, and he still felt choked up whenever he recalled it. But this was different. This time, he was innocent. The woman detective came in, carrying a cardboard file folder. She had taken off her jacket, but she still wore the gun on her belt. She was an attractive black woman of about 40, a little on the heavy side, and she had an "I'm in charge" air. Steve looked at her with relief. "Thank God," he said. "For what?" "That something is happening. I don't want to be here all damn night." Would you sit down, please? Steve sat. My name is Sergeant Michelle Delaware. She took a sheet of paper from the folder and put it on the table. What's your full name and address? He told her, and she wrote it on the form. Age?
22.
Education?
I have a college degree.
She wrote on the form, then pushed it across to him. It was headed, Police Department, Baltimore, Maryland. Explanation of Rights, Form 69. Please read the 5 sentences on the form, then write your initials in the spaces provided beside each sentence. She passed him a pen. He read the form and started to initial.
You have to read aloud, she said.
He thought for a moment.
So that you know I'm literate? He asked.
No, it's so that you can't later pretend to be illiterate and claim that you were not informed of your rights. This was the kind of thing they did not teach you in law school.
He read, You are hereby advised that, 1, you have the absolute right to remain silent.
He wrote SL in the space at the end of the line, then read on, initialing each sentence.
2, anything you say or write may be used against you in a court of law. 3, you have the right to talk with a lawyer at any time, before any questioning, before answering any questions, or during any questioning. 4, if you want a lawyer and cannot afford to hire one, you will not be asked any questions, and the court will be requested to appoint a lawyer for you. 5, if you agree to answer questions, you may stop at any time and request a lawyer, and no further questions will be asked of you.
Now sign your name, please. She pointed to the form. Here and here. The first space for signature was underneath the sentence, I have read the above explanation of my rights, and I fully understand it. Signature.
Steve signed.
And just below, she said.
I am willing to answer questions, and I do not want any attorney at this time. My decision to answer questions without having an attorney present is free and voluntary on my part.
Signature.
He signed and said, How the hell do you get guilty people to sign that?
She did not answer him. She printed her name, then signed the form.
She put the form back in the folder and looked at him.
You're in trouble, Steve, she said. But you seem like a regular guy.
Why don't you just tell me what happened?
I can't, he said. I wasn't there. I guess I just looked like the jerk that did it.
She sat back, crossed her legs, and gave him a friendly smile.
I know men, she said in an intimate tone. They have urges.
If I didn't know better, Steve thought, I'd read her body language and say she was coming on to me.
She went on.
Let me tell you what I think. You're an attractive man. She took a shine to you.
I've never met this woman, Sergeant.
She ignored that. Leaning across the table, she covered his hand with her own.
I think she provoked you.
Steve looked at her hand. She had good nails, manicured, not too long, varnished with clear nail polish. But the hand was wrinkled.
She was older than 40, maybe 45.
She spoke in a conspiratorial voice, as if to say, This is just between you and me.
She was asking for it, so you gave it to her. Am I right?
Why the hell would you think that? Steve said with irritation. I know what girls are like. She led you on. Then, at the last minute, she changed her mind. But it was too late. A man can't just stop just like that. Not a real man.
Oh, wait. I get it, Steve said. The suspect agrees with you, imagining that he's making it look better for himself. But in fact, he's admitted that intercourse took place, and half of your job is done.
Sergeant Delaware sat back, looking annoyed, and Steve figured he had guessed right. She stood up.
Okay, smartass. Come with me.
Where are we going?
The cells.
Wait a minute. When's the lineup?
As soon as we can reach the victim and bring her in here.
You can't hold me indefinitely without some court procedure. We can hold you for 24 hours without any procedure. So button your lip and let's go.
She took him down in the elevator and through a door into a lobby that was painted a dull orange-brown. A notice on the wall reminded officers to keep suspects handcuffed while searching them. The turnkey, a black policeman in his 50s, stood at a high counter. "Hey, Spike," said Sergeant Delaware, "got a smart-ass college boy for you." The turnkey grinned.
"If he's so smart, how come he's in here?"
They both laughed. Steve made a mental note not to tell cops, in the future, when he had second-guessed them. It was a failing of his. He had antagonized his schoolteachers the same way.
Nobody liked a wise guy.
The cop called Spike was small and wiry, with gray hair and a little mustache. He had a perky air, but there was a cold look in his eyes. He opened a steel door.
"You coming through to the cells, Mish?" he said. "I gotta ask you to check your weapon, if so."
"No, I'm finished with him for now," she said. "He'll be in a lineup later." She turned and left.
"This way, boy," the turnkey said to Steve.
He went through the door. He was in the cell block. The walls and floor were the same muddy color. Steve thought the elevator had stopped at the second floor, but there were no windows, and he felt as if he were in a cavern deep underground, and it would take him a long time to climb back to the surface. In a little anteroom was a desk and a camera on a stand. Spike took a form from a pigeonhole. Reading it upside down, Steve saw it was headed, Police Department, Baltimore, Maryland. Prisoner Activity Report, Form 92/12. The man took the cap off a ballpoint pen and began to fill out the form. When it was done, he pointed to a spot on the ground and said, "Stand right there." Steve stood in front of the camera. Spike pressed a button, and there was a flash. "Turn sideways." There was another flash. Next, Spike took out a square card printed in pink ink and headed, "Federal Bureau of Investigation, United States Department of Justice, Washington, D.C., 20537. Spike inked Steve's fingers and thumbs on a pad, then pressed them to squares on the card marked 1, R thumb, 2, R index, and so on. Steve noticed that Spike, though a small man, had big hands with prominent veins. As he did so, Spike said conversationally, "We have a new central booking facility over at the city jail on Greenmount Avenue, and they have a computer that takes your prints without ink. It's like a big photocopy machine. You just press your hands on the glass. But down here, we're still using the dirty old system." Steve realized he was beginning to feel ashamed, even though he had not committed a crime. It was partly the grim surroundings, but mainly the feeling of powerlessness. Ever since the cops burst out of the patrol car outside Jeannie's house, he had been moved around like a piece of meat, with no control over himself. It brought a man's self-esteem down fast. When his fingerprints were done, he was allowed to wash his hands.
"Permit me to show you to your suite," Spike said jovially.
He led Steve down the corridor with cells to the left and right. Each cell was roughly square. On the side that gave onto the corridor, there was no wall, just bars, so that every square inch of the cell was clearly visible from outside. Through the bars, Steve could see that each cell had a metal bunk fixed to the wall and a stainless steel toilet and wash basin. The walls and bunks were painted orange-brown and covered with graffiti. The toilets had no lids. In 3 or 4 of the cells, a man lay listlessly on the bunk, but most of them were empty.
"Monday's a quiet day here at the Lafayette Street Holiday Inn," Spike joked.
Steve could not have laughed to save his life. Spike stopped in front of an empty cell. Steve stared inside as the cop unlocked the door. There was no privacy. Steve realized that if he needed to use the toilet, he would have to do it in full view of anyone, man or woman, who happened to be walking along the corridor. Somehow, that was more humiliating than anything else. Spike opened the gate in the bars and ushered Steve inside. The gate crashed shut, and Spike locked it. Steve sat on the bunk.
"Jesus Christ Almighty, what a place," he said.
"You get used to it," Spike said cheerfully, and he went away. A minute later, he came back, carrying a styrofoam package.
"I got a dinner left," he said. "Fried chicken. You want some?"
Steve looked at the package, then at the open toilet, and shook his head.
"Thanks all the same," he said. "I guess I'm not hungry."
10. Barrington ordered champagne. Jeannie would have liked a good slug of Stolichnaya on the rocks after the kind of day she had had, but drinking hard liquor was no way to impress an employer, and she decided to keep her desire to herself. Champagne meant romance. On previous occasions when they had met socially, he had been charming rather than amorous. Was he now going to make a pass at her? It made her uneasy. She had never met a man who could take rejection with good grace. And this man was her boss. She did not tell him about Steve, either. She was on the point of doing so several times during their dinner, but something held her back. If, against all her expectations, Steve did turn out to be a criminal, her theory would start to look shaky. But she did not like to anticipate bad news. Before it was proved, she would not foster doubts, and she felt sure it would all turn out to be an appalling mistake. She had talked to Lisa. "They've arrested Brad Pitt," she had said. Lisa was horrified to think that the man had spent the entire day at Nuthouse, her place of work, and that Jeannie had been on the point of taking him into her home. Jeannie had explained that she was sure Steve was not really the perpetrator. Later, she realized, she probably should not have made the call. It might be construed as interfering with a witness. Not that it would make any real difference. Lisa would look at a row of young white men, and either she would see the man who raped her, or she would not. It was not the kind of thing she would make a mistake about. Jeannie had also spoken to her mother. Patty had been there today, with her three sons, and Mom talked animatedly about how the boys had raced around the corridors of the home. Mercifully, she seemed to have forgotten that it was only yesterday she had moved into Bella Vista. She talked as if she had lived there for years, and reproached Jeannie for not visiting more often. After the conversation, Jeannie felt a little better about her mother. "How is the sea bass?" Barrington said, interrupting her thoughts. "Delicious. Very delicate." He smoothed his eyebrows with the tip of his right index finger. For some reason, the gesture struck her as self-congratulatory. "Now I'm going to ask you a question, and you have to answer honestly." He smiled so that she would not take him too seriously.
"Okay. Do you like dessert?"
"Yes. Do you take me for the kind of woman who would pretend about a thing like that?" He shook his head.
"I guess there's not much you do pretend about."
"Not enough, probably. I have been called tactless."
"Your worst failing."
"I could probably do better if I thought about it." "What's your worst failing?"
Barrington answered without hesitation. "Falling in love."
"That's a failing?"
"It is if you do it too often."
"Or with more than one person at a time, I guess."
"Maybe I should write to Lorraine Logan and ask her advice."
Jeannie laughed, but she did not want the conversation to get on to Stephen. "Who's your favorite painter?" she said.
"See if you can guess."
Barrington was a super patriot, so he must be sentimental, she figured. "Norman Rockwell?"
"Certainly not."
He seemed genuinely horrified.
"A vulgar illustrator."
"No.
If I could afford to collect paintings, I'd buy American Impressionists. John Henry Twakman's Winter Landscapes. I'd love to own the White Bridge."
"How about you?"
"Now you have to guess."
He thought for a moment.
"Juan Miró."
"Why?"
"I imagine you like bold splashes of color."
She nodded. "Perceptive, but not quite right. Miró's too messy. I prefer Mondrian."
"Ah, yes, of course. The straight line."
"Exactly. You're good at this." He shrugged, and she realized he had probably played guessing games with many women. She dipped a spoon into her mango sorbet. This was definitely not a business dinner. Soon she would have to make a firm decision about what her relationship with Barrington was going to be. She had not kissed a man for a year and a half,
Since Will Temple walked out on her, she had not even been on a date until today. She was not carrying a torch for Will. She no longer loved him, but she was wary. However, she was going crazy living the life of a nun. She missed having someone hairy in bed with her. She missed the masculine smells, bicycle oil and sweaty football shirts and whiskey. And most of all, she missed the sex. When radical feminists said the penis was the enemy, Jeannie wanted to reply, "Speak for yourself, sister." She glanced up at Barrington, delicately eating caramelized apples. She liked the guy, despite his nasty politics. He was smart. Her men had to be intelligent. And he had winning ways. She respected him for his scientific work. He was slim and fit-looking. He was probably a very experienced and skillful lover. And he had nice blue eyes. All the same, he was too old. She liked mature men, but not that mature. How could she reject him without ruining her career? The best course might be to pretend to interpret his intention as kindly and paternal. That way, she might avoid spurning him outright. She took a sip of champagne. The waiter kept refilling her glass, and she was not sure how much she had drunk, but she was glad she did not have to drive. They ordered coffee. Jeannie asked for a double espresso to sober her up. When Barrington had paid the bill, they took the elevator to the parking garage and got in his silver Lincoln town car. Barrington drove along the harbor side and got onto the Jones Falls Expressway. "There's the city jail," he said, pointing to a fortress-like building that occupied a city block. "The scum of the earth are in there." Steve might be in there, Jeannie thought. How had she ever contemplated sleeping with Barrington? She did not feel the least warmth of affection for him. She felt ashamed that she had even toyed with the idea. As he pulled up to the curb outside her house, she said firmly, "Well, Barry, thank you for a charming evening." Would he shake hands, she wondered, or try to kiss her? If he tried to kiss her, she would offer her cheek. But he did neither. "My phone at home is out of order, and I need to make one call before I go to bed," he said. "May I use your phone?" She could hardly say, "Hell no, stop by a payphone." It looked as if she were going to have to deal with a determined past. "Of course," she said, suppressing a sigh. "Come on up." She wondered if she could avoid offering him coffee. She jumped out of the car and led the way across the row stoop. The front door gave onto a tiny lobby with two more doors. One led to the ground floor apartment, occupied by Mr. Oliver, a retired stevedore. The other, Jeannie's door, opened onto the staircase that led up to her second floor apartment. She frowned, puzzled. Her door was open. She went inside and led the way up the stairs. A light was on up there. That was curious. She had left before dark. The staircase led directly into her living room. She stepped inside and screamed. He was standing at her refrigerator with a bottle of vodka in his hand. He was scruffy and unshaven, and he seemed a little drunk. Behind her, Barrington said, "What's going on?" "You need better security in here, Jeannie," the intruder said. "I picked your locks in about 10 seconds. Barrington said, "Who the hell is he?" Jeannie said in a shocked voice, "When did you get out of jail, Daddy?" 11. The lineup room was on the same floor as the cells. In the anteroom were 6 other men of about Steve's age and build. He guessed they were cops. They did not speak to him and avoided his gaze. They were treating him like a criminal. He wanted to say, "Hey, guys, I'm on your side. I'm not a rapist. I'm innocent." They all had to take off their wristwatches and jewelry and put on white paper coveralls over their clothes. While they were getting ready, a young man in a suit came in and said, "Which of you is the suspect, please?" "That's me," Steve said. "I'm Lou Tanner, the public defender," the man said. "I'm here to make sure the lineup is run correctly." "Do you have any questions?" "How long will it take me to get out of here afterwards?" Steve said. "Assuming you're not picked out of the lineup, a couple of hours." 2 hours, Steve said indignantly. "Do I have to go back in that fucking cell?" "I'm afraid so." Jesus Christ. I'll ask them to handle your discharge as fast as possible, Lou said. Anything else? No, thanks.
Okay.
He went out. A turnkey ushered the seven men through a door onto a stage. There was a backdrop with a graduated scale that showed their height and positions numbered 1 to 10. A powerful light shone on them, and a screen divided the stage from the rest of the room. The men could not see through the screen, but they could hear what was going on beyond it. For a while, there was nothing but footsteps and occasional low voices, all male. Then Steve heard the unmistakable sound of a woman's steps. After a moment, a man's voice spoke, sounding as if he were reading from a card or repeating something by rote.
Standing before you are seven people. They will be known to you by number only. If any of these individuals have done anything to you, or in your presence, I want you to call out their number, and number only. If you would like any of them to speak, say any form of specific words, we will have them say those words. If you would like to have them turn around or face sideways, then they will do that as a group. Do you recognize any one of them who has done anything to you or in your presence?
There was a silence. Steve's nerves were wound up tight as guitar strings, even though he was sure she would not pick him out. A low female voice said, "He had a hat on." She sounded like an educated middle-class woman of about his own age, Steve thought. The male voice said, "We have hats. Would you like them all to put on a hat?" It was more of a cap. A baseball cap. Steve heard anxiety and tension in her voice, but also determination. There was no hint of falseness. She sounded like the kind of woman who would tell the truth, even when distressed. He felt a little better.
"Dave, see if we have seven baseball caps in that closet."
There was a pause of several minutes. Steve ground his teeth in impatience. A voice muttered, "Geez, I didn't know we had all this stuff. Eyeglasses, mustaches."
"No chit-chat, please, Dave," the first man said.
"This is a formal legal proceeding." Eventually, a detective came onto the stage from the side and handed a baseball cap to each man in the lineup. They all put them on, and the detective left. From the other side of the screen came the sound of a woman crying. The male voice repeated the form of words used earlier. "Do you recognize any one of them who has done anything to you or in your presence? If so, call out their number, and number only."
"Number 4, she said with a sob in her voice.
Steve turned and looked at the backdrop. He was number 4.
"No," he shouted. "This can't be right. It wasn't me."
The male voice said,
"Number 4. Did you hear that?" "Of course I heard it, but I didn't do this."
The other men in the lineup were already leaving the stage.
"For Christ's sake!"
Steve stared at the opaque screen, his arms spread wide in a pleading gesture.
"How could you pick me out? I don't even know what you look like."
The male voice from the other side said, "Don't say anything, ma'am, please. Thank you very much for your cooperation. This way out."
"There's something wrong here. Can't you understand?" Steve yelled.
The turnkey Spike appeared.
"It's all over, son. Let's go," he said.
Steve stared at him. For a moment he was tempted to knock the little man's teeth down his throat. Spike saw the look in his eye, and his expression hardened.
"Let's have no trouble now. You got nowhere to run."
He took Steve's arm in a grip that felt like a steel clamp. It was useless to protest. Steve felt as if he had been bludgeoned from behind. This had come from nowhere. His shoulders slumped, and he was seized by helpless fury.
"How did this happen?" he said.
"How did this happen?"
12. Barrington said,
"Daddy?"
Jeannie wanted to bite off her tongue. It was the dumbest thing she could have said.
"When did you get out of jail, Daddy?"
Only minutes ago, Barrington had described the people in the city jail as the scum of the earth. She felt mortified. It was bad enough her boss finding out that her father was a professional burglar. Having Barrington meet him was even worse.
His face had been bruised by a fall, and he had several days' growth of beard. His clothes were dirty, and he had a faint but disgusting smell. She felt so ashamed, she could not look at Barrington. There had been a time, many years ago, when she was not ashamed of him. Quite the reverse. He made other girls' fathers seem boring and tiresome. He had been handsome and fun-loving, and he would come home in a new suit, his pockets full of money. There would be movies and new dresses and ice cream sundaes, and Mom would buy a pretty nightgown and go on a diet. But he always went away again, and around about the age of 9, she found out why. Tammy Fontaine told her. She would never forget the conversation. "Your jumper's horrible," Tammy had said. "Your nose is horrible," Jeannie had replied wittily, and the other girls broke up. "Your mom buys you clothes that are really, like, gruesome. Your mom's fat. Your daddy's in jail." "He is not."
"He is so."
"He is not. I heard my daddy tell my mommy. He was reading the newspaper. 'I see old Pete Ferrami's back in jail again,' he said." "Liar, liar, pants on fire," Jeannie had chanted. But in her heart, she had believed Tammy. It explained everything. The sudden wealth, the equally sudden disappearances, the long absences. Jeannie never had another of those taunting schoolgirl conversations. Anyone could shut her up by mentioning her father. At the age of 9, it was like being crippled for life. Whenever something was lost at school, she felt they all looked accusingly at her. She never shook the guilty feeling. If another woman looked in her purse and said, "Darn, I thought I had a $10 bill," Jeannie would flush crimson. She became obsessively honest. She would walk a mile to return a cheap ballpoint, terrified that if she kept it, the owner would say she was a thief like her father. Now here he was, standing there in front of her boss, dirty and unshaven and probably broke. "This is Professor Barrington Jones," she said. "Barry, meet my father, Pete Ferrami." Barrington was gracious. He shook Daddy's hand. "Good to meet you, Mr. Ferrami," he said. "Your daughter is a very special woman." "Ain't that the truth?" Daddy said with a pleased grin. "Well, Barry, now you know the family secret," she said resignedly. "Daddy was sent to jail for the third time on the day I graduated summa cum laude from Princeton. He's been incarcerated for the last 8 years."
"It could have been 15, Daddy said. "We had guns on that job."
"Thank you for sharing that with us, Dad. It's sure to impress my boss." Daddy looked hurt and baffled, and she felt a stab of pity for him, despite her resentment. His weakness hurt him as much as it hurt his family. He was one of nature's failures, the fabulous system that reproduced the human race. The profoundly complex DNA mechanism Jeannie studied was programmed to make every individual a little bit different. It was like a photocopier with a built-in error. Sometimes the result was good, an Einstein, a Louis Armstrong, an Andrew Carnegie. And sometimes it was a Pete Ferrami. Jeannie had to get rid of Barrington fast. "If you want to make that call, Barry, you can use the phone in the bedroom."
"It'll keep," he said. "Thank God for that."
"Well, thank you for a very special evening." She held out her hand to shake. "It was a pleasure. Good night." He shook hands awkwardly and went out.